Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply. Not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.
From KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Ariana Prale. Writer and cultural critic Rebecca Carroll grew up the only black person in a small rural New England town. Adopted by white parents when she was a baby, Carroll never met another black person in real life until she was 6 years old. Her new memoir, Surviving the White Gaze, recounts episodes from her childhood and adolescence in which the people who love her most fail to see her for who she is, and how she overcame the feelings of isolation to forge her own identity as a black woman. We'll talk with Rebecca Carroll about her story and about experiences of transracial adoption. That's next, after this news. Good morning. Welcome to Forum. I'm Ariana Prale, and I will be your host in the 9 o'clock hour this week. As you know, Forum is changing. Mina Kim has been named the host of the statewide 10 to 11 a.m. hour, and we're hoping to bring you lots of voices here as we search for a new host at 9 a.m. You may have heard me filling in here and there in recent months, and I look forward to being in conversation with you and a range of guests in the coming days, starting with today's guest, Rebecca Carroll. She's the author of several books, including Sugar in the Raw, Voices of Young Black Girls in America, and has written for outlets such as the New York Times, The Atlantic, and Essence. She previously served as a cultural critic at public radio station WNYC and as a critic at large for the LA Times. And she joins us now to talk about her new memoir, Surviving the White Gaze, about growing up as a black girl who was born to a white mother and black father and raised by white adoptive parents in a small rural town, and about her journey to claim her identity as a black woman. Welcome to Forum, Rebecca Carroll.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So I know over the course of this conversation, we'll be unpacking kind of your experience with the white gaze, but I thought it might be helpful if we kind of started with a shared definition for this conversation of that. So how do you define the white gaze?
You know, I think that that is an interesting idea, right, to have a shared definition of it. As I have done this virtual tour and responded to that question, I keep sort of thinking about ways in which I can kind of diversify my answer. Because the simplest form is, you know, the simplest definition is it's the default. It is the backdrop of America. It is the approximation or proximity to whiteness that decides the standard of beauty, the standard of intellect, the standard of education, the standard of style, all of these things. It's a default. It is what is white or what is in proximity to whiteness is what is valuable.
And so tell us about some of your earliest memories of what life was like in rural New Hampshire with your parents, who you refer to as mom and dad in the book. You sometimes refer to your dad as Dave, too. Yeah, can you kind of place us in that childhood?
As I write in the book, an open with the chapter of the first 6 years of my life, which were truly idyllic. We lived in an old farmhouse on the top of a dirt hill road, surrounded by nature and gardens. And my mom was incredibly attentive to me and my older brother and sister, who are my parents' biological children. You know, we played all day and we had tea in the afternoon and my mom would make fresh cookies. And, you know, it was idyllic, but for some things that I won't get into here that come to, you know, that come to a head later on in the book. But I opened that way so that folks could, I mean, that if we're talking about definitions of the white gaze, that's the white gaze, right? A childhood, a atmosphere, a microcosm, completely void of race, completely void of blackness. And just through the lens of my, particularly my dad, but my parents' sort of scope of what idyllic means.
And you got to know your biological mother, Tess, a white woman, when you were young. 11 years old, was it?
Yeah.
At that time?
Mm-hmm.
And for a long time, you sought her approval. I mean, that's a big piece of the book. But and you were seeking her approval also when Tess held some racist views about Black people and would express them to you in conversation, which was heartbreaking to read about. Can you talk about some of the layers of that relationship and how it impacted you?
Well, I would say that for any adoptee, this sort of strange kind of fantasy of where you came from, and you know, it's kind of this dichotomous feeling of fantasy, because this woman or these parents must be extraordinary, but also they didn't choose to keep me. So there is, you know, this sort of inherent kind of hope and desire and constant reconciliation with the sort of deeply internalized abandonment. But I also, you know, was an incredibly social, outward, expressive child. I was really creative, and I just was full of absolute innocence and naivete about meeting this woman who I just was so excited to meet and know about and connect to. And that was not how she came to it. And so, you know, it was almost impossible for me. And what I knew is that she had given me up as a teenager. She was 17 when she had me. And so it was really hard for me to separate that 17-year-old from the 27-year-old who I met, who was dealing with her own sort of, you know, trauma and feelings about having given me up, although she was the one to reach out for us to meet. So it was fraught, obviously, from the beginning, including the fact that I was too young and was given sort of free rein to choose whether or not I wanted to, you know, pursue that relationship. My parents were fairly laissez-faire as parents. And so I, you know, I sort of went into this, off into this bizarre sunset of trying to win her approval while also trying to hold on to whatever sense of self I had as an 11-year-old coming from this weird, idyllic, you know, artist family, while also starting to have these experiences that sort of marked my race in a way that was, I didn't really have the tools. And I certainly was taken aback by the first couple of things that happened early on. You know, my fifth grade teacher telling me I was pretty for a Black girl. That was bad enough, but the part that came after was really what scarred me, I would say, is that most Black girls are very ugly. And other sorts of things that happened. And my birth mother was kind of cavalier in her appropriation and or understanding or presumption of Blackness and race in a way that I didn't understand as racist until much later on.
Hmm. And I know some of that tension you navigated showed up when Tess showed you a couple pictures of your birth father, Joe Banks, for the mm-hmm. first time. Can you talk about that moment and how she talked about him? And then I know I asked about having you read an excerpt, and then we can transition into that. But first, tell us that moment of seeing the photos of your birth father.
Sure. All right. Well, it was actually the very first question that I asked her when we met when I was 11 years old. I asked her about him. What was he like? And she said, basically, he was a dog. And so we didn't talk about him until I was as a teenager, when I started to seek out and socialize with other Black teenagers and peers in the town where she lived, which boasted a small Black community. And she showed me these pictures, and I remember feeling connected to them in the way that, you know, I had started to have Black friends. I had started to be attracted to and drawn to Black boys. And I started thinking, what would it be like to hear my Black father talk to me about these boys or how to carry myself or, you know, just my path. And it was, you know, it was a really like, I got lost in this moment of looking at these pictures, you know, this profile, he had this chiseled jaw and sunglasses and he just looked so cool. And he was mine in that moment of looking at those pictures. And then I said to my birth mother, do you know if I was his only child? And she said, I don't know, but you know, Black men are out here having kids with all sorts of different women. So who knows? And it's sort of like, it decimated that moment of, you know, of reverie that I was having. And that was also sort of, again, one of those instances where I was like, that's not good, but I didn't know how to identify it as racism. And also, you know, all of the sort of guiding forces, you know, the people that you defer to for definition, for understanding, for giving you the tools of understanding, they were all white. All of the parents in this particular carousel, my adoptive parents, my birth mother, my teachers, everybody was white, and nobody had given me the tools and or the permission to call out something as racist.
Right. And another striking thing, and actually, because we're going to be coming up on a break soon, so we'll hold the excerpt for when we come back.
Okay.
But there was, I noticed that you also sometimes use kind of the language of addiction in terms of talking about that relationship with your mother. And it really kind of brings out this seeking that you had of just really trying to, where you hadn't been given that language and tools of like really kind of latching on to kind of whatever came in, whether it was kind of toxic or not in those definitions. Can you speak a little, we have maybe about a minute and a half, but speak a little bit about those feelings, because I know you said, I folded into the mere sound of Tessa's voice, dizzying, liquid and lethal, like freebase cocaine shimmering in its heated spoon. I mean, that's quite an image.
So again, going back to the kind of adoptees and this already kind of reconciliation with abandonment, right? You pair abandonment with something that feels good from the person who gave you away. And that is drug-like, right? She was super charismatic, super funny, really bright. And I was so young that it was easy to sort of lose myself in the power of her existence, her personality, in the hope that that would ultimately result in her love and acceptance.
Yeah. We're talking with Rebecca Carroll, cultural critic and author of Surviving the White Gaze, about transracial adoption and growing up Black in a white family. What questions do you have for Rebecca Carroll? Does her experience with the white gaze resonate with you in any way? Do you have an experience of transracial adoption as an adoptive parent or a person who was adopted? Share your experience with us. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Ariana Prale. More back after the break. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ariana Prale. We're talking with writer and cultural critic Rebecca Carroll, author of the new memoir Surviving the White Gaze, about being adopted as a child into a white family in a white town and her journey to find her identity as a Black woman. And before the break, we were talking about your experience of seeing the photos of your birth father for the first time. And it was that conversation with your birth mother, Tess, that sparked your interest in asking your dad, your adoptive father, about any relationships he had with Black people. And so I'm wondering if you can read the excerpt of that exchange in your book for us.
Sure. "The Blacks mostly kept to themselves," Dad said plainly, when I asked him if he'd ever had any Black friends. "But I mostly was interested in girls and turtles, of course. But there were Black students at your school in Groton, right?" Dad had gone to a public high school in Groton, Connecticut, which, he'd told me before, was integrated with Black students. "Yes, a handful," he said. "But like I said, they really just preferred to keep to themselves. Did you ever think that might be about self-preservation in a predominantly white environment? I never really thought about it, Beck, Dad said. Did you think about trying to make friends with any of them? They weren't interested in being friends with white people. And since then, though, I said, struggling to map this out in my brain, no Black friends. You and Mom have never had Black friends. Well, look around, Beck, Dad laughed, thinking the whiteness of our town and immediate surroundings was funny. That's kind of my point, Dad. Look around. Of course, there was my friend Lee Ling when I was at the museum school, Dad offered, and he was just a great friend and all. Also Chinese. Yes, Li Ling was this little Chinese guy, funny as hell, Dad said. I don't know, Beck. I've mostly just chosen to live in places where there aren't that many humans in general. I really need to be around the natural world. But didn't you think it might be important if you're raising a Black child for her to see other Black people? Mom and I both really thought the world was changing and that people were coming toward each other, Dad said. We really believed what Martin Luther King was saying, and you know, we had those wonderful years on the hill together and all. And this beautiful house we have now, I mean, how lucky are we? I didn't show the two pictures I had of my birth father to Dad. Instead, I kept them and him and us to ourselves, like the Black kids he described in high school.
So the invocation of Dr. King is really striking there because it feels like a shield, you know, from having to face a perhaps uncomfortable reality, the reality you were experiencing, right? Feeling isolated, all the microaggressions you write about experiencing at school.
That's not new. I mean, you know, that's the use of Martin Luther King as a tool for white liberals to deflect racism is, you know, has been as far back as I can recall as a Black child growing up in white rural New Hampshire. But I also think it's so indicative of where the thinking and the engagement stopped for them. You know, it was this moment of civil rights. It was this moment where Martin Luther King was trying to bring everybody together. And that was enough for them to sort of proceed with their plan without thinking what might happen after, you know, not just Martin Luther King being assassinated, but all of the work that was being done for civil rights and Black folks, and that there was no engagement whatsoever with that in regard to their own lives, for their own education, but as parents of a Black child.
Let's go to a caller, Mike in El Cerrito. You're on.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. My question is for, you know, white parents who have considered adopting and generally look at it through a lens of openness, no preconception as to race of a child that you might want to adopt, and just having an open household to any race. You know, is there really, you know, a downside to adopting a person of color for their best interest? You know, it seems like there's a great opportunity for at least there to be confusion, or at worst there to be a lifelong, you know, deep troubled sense of self. And I would want to make sure that I'm doing the best thing for the child. And it seems like the most open thing would be surely to not have any preconception of race, but is it in fact damaging to, you know, to approach it in that way? It's really, I would want to make sure it's best for the child, but at the same time, you know, it seems like it could be, you know, very tricky. And I would like to hear your perspective for white parents who are considering to do this in the right way.
Thanks.
So
Mike.
a couple things there. Thank you for the question. First of all, what does openness mean? See, this is one of those things that I feel potential white adoptive parents sort of approach this idea as being open. Open to what? Open to something that is other than white, right? There again is where the white gaze plays into it. You know, not having preconceived notions about race. It's not about having preconceived notions. It's about having a conversant level of awareness around race. And in terms of what is right for the child, again, the white gaze, you know, the presumption that white parents can even make that decision for a Black child or a child of color, the way to approach it is by deference and education. And, you know, what is right for a child or a Black child or adoptive child of color is for white parents to be as engaged, as immersed and conversant in whatever culture, race, or ethnicity of the child they are adopting without appropriating or exotifying.
And I've heard kind of related in that too, is I've heard you say that well-meaning and well-intentioned are useless terms at this point. Can you share more about what you mean by that? Because I feel like it ties in kind of with Mike's question in terms of wanting to go without the preconceived notions or having this intention behind talking about race with your child or something like that.
Because what we did in this country is we went, you know, the dynamic between white people and Black people, we went from enslavement to, okay, you can have your freedom. Okay, maybe we'll let you drink from this faucet. Okay, actually, I mean, all of this kind of like giving permission for us to exist is not a good indicator of there's no real evolution or arc that makes me feel like white parents necessarily or inherently know how to manage a Black child or child of color, given the dynamic that has been at the center of this country in terms of race. And so this notion of well-meaning also comes from that same place of I mean well, I'm well-intentioned, but what is the intention? What we have to interrogate what it means for a white person to say, my intentions are pure. Shouldn't your intentions not even be part of this? shouldn't you just actually be in conversation with the reality of this person's experience?
We're talking with Rebecca Carroll, cultural critic and author of Surviving the White Gaze, about transracial adoption and growing up Black in a white family. Let us know what questions you have for her, if her experience with the white gaze resonates with you in any way, and do you have an experience of transracial adoption as an adoptive parent or a person who was adopted? Share your experience with us. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Something else that, while reading your memoir, had me reflecting on how difficult it is to process an understanding of racial identity as a child and as an adolescent when no one has provided, as you were saying before, and I want to come back to this, that no one has provided a space for that or given you language. And for as much as we might like to say, well, kids shouldn't be burdened with that, or your dad, you know, invoking Dr. King is kind of a get out of talking about race card. You know, we live in a society where race and racism are factors, are reality. And I think about the scene where you've met Jasmine, a Black girl who invites you to hang out with her and her friends on a school trip, and you respond, I'd love that. And then correct yourself to say, I mean, yeah, that'd be cool. You know, a correction that kind of came from wanting to sound less quote unquote white and more quote unquote Black. And I think those kinds of moments speak to this, you know, desire to reconcile something. This is a young brain, you know, trying to make sense of feeling different and not fully accepted. Can you talk about what that felt like for you? Because there were a number of instances through the course of the book where you're in a place of literally searching for the language of how you want to be in the world.
I love that you brought up that interaction, because it's really such a joy to reflect on. And I mean, part of that was I was so excited. Like, I had to sort of rein myself in that she had extended this invitation. So I wanted to sound less white, but also less like a geek, you know, like less like someone who was just, yes, I would love that. But it was also a moment where it would have been super useful to know that was sort of code switching, right? Like, nobody ever told me anything about that, the idea of sounding white or sounding Black, and that I could do both, that was within my right, as opposed to being judged by mainly my white peers and my white birth mother. But what that felt like was real. It felt, I didn't feel like I was pretending. It felt like I was at the sort of nascent stages of learning this language. Mm-hmm. And that Jasmine was really welcoming, in that.
Let's go to another caller, Dell in Oakland. You're on.
Hi. I hear a lot of white parents who adopt children of color say, oh, well, they'll be okay. They'll work it out. I'm actually a white parent of a beautiful black young man, and I'm blessed enough that his birth mom is in the picture. But growing, you know, I am very aware that there is going to have to be representation for him in his life. Like you need to expose him to people that are like him. You know, we're both females. And so, for me, we need to work hard on finding him a black represented male that he can look up to, that he, you know, not just one, but these are things that as a parent, you need to think about. You need to make sure that your child is represented in your life at all times. And so for white parents to be like, oh, they're going to be okay. No, there needs to be history. We don't teach black history in school, period, which is a major problem. But these are things that we need to think about. Our child is going to learn about black history. That's the first thing he's going to learn about. Because that's our job as parents, is to make sure that they feel comfortable in their skin.
Thanks for that comment, Dell. And I'm just going to add, there's a listener tweet and says, isn't separating a child from her cultural experience a form of emotional abuse? Your reaction to both Dell's comment and this listener tweet, Rebecca?
Yeah. I mean, I write about this in the book. It's like, who thinks that taking a black child, adopting a black child into a white family, into an all white town, all white schools is healthy? Who thinks that? Only somebody who is willing to, who thinks it's fine for themselves to go from cradle to grave without having black folks in their lives, prioritizing their own needs, which is void of blackness, which is unhealthy, abusive. I wouldn't probably go to that extreme because there's so many other things that I have experienced that are abusive in the context of race. Hmm. But yeah, it's enormously problematic. And I would say to Dell's response or comment, it is important to have representation, but it's also important to have engagement. So it's not just a role model. It's not just two or three teachers, although that is extremely important as well. But it's important for Dell to not just hand off her son to her son's birth mother or, you know, whatever black role model, but for Dell to also be deeply engaged with black history and black culture in a way, again, that is not appropriative or exploitative. And that is something that white folks have had a really, really tough time and a really lousy track record with.
Can you kind of take us through a moment of like when you realized that the white gaze was defining how you saw yourself? I know they're kind of, it kind of came in phases, but do you remember kind of when that first kind of aha was, when you're just like, oh wait, this is a completely kind of warped view that's happening?
You know, I'm in some ways embarrassed to say, like, it wasn't until I was in my 20s and I heard Toni Morrison use the term. Like, I didn't even know, I'd never heard the term white gaze before. And she was on the Charlie Rose Show where I was working, and I was in the control room, and I remember her starting to talk about it. And I was like, oh my God, that's it. That's what I've been trying to get out from under. That's what I've been trying to reconcile. That's what I've been trying to define. And that was the aha moment.
We actually have a cut of that because I think might be great to play and then to kind of just flesh out that story. So here was Toni Morrison responding and talking about the white gaze.
I remember a review of Sula in which the reviewer said, this is all well and good, but one day she, meaning me, will have to face up to the real responsibilities and get mature and write about the real confrontation for black people, which is white people. As though our lives have no meaning and no depth without the white gaze. And I've spent my entire writing life trying to make sure that the white gaze was not the dominant one in any of my books.
So, again, that was Toni Morrison on The Charlie Rose Show. And you were on set that day, as you were describing. You were associate producer of that show at the time. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so continue with just kind of when that really kind of hit you.
Well, first of all, Sula is my favorite Toni Morrison book that I discovered in college. So when she was talking, when she started with Sula, my, you know, already ears had perked up. But then, you know, just this notion of her dedication, her resolute devotion to writing pages and pages and characters and characters and without any white people. Like, it was, the idea was so, it was almost achingly appealing to me, both as a writer and as a black woman. And I didn't really realize it was possible. You know, until I discovered her writing and you know, others, Zora Neale Hurston and Audre Lorde and the rest in college. But it was that moment when I heard her say it that I felt I had to figure out how to reconcile with the ways in which I had been damaged by the white gaze.
We're talking with Rebecca Carroll, cultural critic and author of Surviving the White Gaze, about transracial adoption and growing up black in a white family. Let us know what questions you have. If you have an experience of transracial adoption as an adoptive parent or a person who was adopted, give us a call at 866-733-6786. You can also get in touch on Twitter and Facebook. We're at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. I'm Ariana Prail. More with our guest Rebecca Carroll after the break.
Support for Forum is sponsored by Stanford's Master of Liberal Arts program. Have you found yourself reflecting on your life and education? Perhaps you think it's too late or you're too busy to earn a master's degree. Stanford's part-time MLA program is designed for anyone, from recent college grads to retirees who'd like to pursue an interdisciplinary course of study in the liberal arts. MLA students also enjoy access to the world-class facilities on the Stanford campus. Information session held May 16th. Learn more at mla.stanford.edu.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Ariana Prail. We're talking with writer and cultural critic Rebecca Carroll, author of the new memoir Surviving the White Gaze, about being adopted as a child into a white family in a white town and her journey to find her identity as a black woman. So let's go to another caller, Julaine in Oakland. You're on.
Hi. First of all, I just want to say thank you for your responses to the questions so far. But my question is, how have you been accepted or not accepted in the black community? I'm a transracially adopted Korean, and I regularly experience marginalization by the Asian American community. And I'm just wondering what advice you would have to transracially adopted people to how to be, how to deal with that in the navigation of the communities that they are a part of, but yet are often excluded from.
Thanks, Jillian.
Yeah, that's a great question. Thank you for that. And so I would say that in college, when I had my first black professor, you know, that was the first time that I sort of realized that there wasn't just one way to be black, and that we are not a monolith. You know, that's something we talk about a lot. now, but back then, not so much. And that was a very freeing thing for me. And I started a Black student union without knowing what I was doing at all. You know, I had certainly had Black peers question, you know, my authenticity about the way, you know, based on the way that I dressed, and that I clearly had no idea what I was doing with my hair and so forth. But when I realized and embraced the idea that we are not a monolith, and that we could be, that I can be Black the way that I want to be Black, and this did not happen overnight, I decided, you know, that would sort of be the guiding force in my early work, right? So I have done five interview-based books, which are all about Blackness and Black culture and Black writing. The most sort of commercially successful one is Sugar in the Raw, which is about young Black girls. And I traveled all across the country and interviewed over 50 girls from, you know, Burlington, Vermont, with, you know, in a rural setting similar to mine, to Oakland, to, you know, Birmingham, just to sort of verify for myself that we didn't have to be one way. And so I would say to, you know, I mean, I can only speak from my own, from my experience, but I can say, having had Korean and Chinese adoptive friends and mentees, that, you know, it's a conversation with the folks who are marginalizing you. And it's a willingness and a sense of self that you can bring to the conversation, wherein you call out that marginalization and stand in your space, stand in your sense of self, because no matter what anybody says, you are Korean American, you are that. However you choose to express that, cultivate that, live in that is your authentic identity.
And Rebecca Carroll, can you also talk about the role of chosen family? It's somewhat related in helping you become yourself.
Yeah. Thank God for chosen family. So one of my best, dearest friends to this day, we met when we were in our early 20s, and we moved to New York together, to Brooklyn. Now our sons are a year apart, you know, we spend holidays together, but, you know, unlike, I had kind of interactions with Black folks, starting in my teen years and then in college, and I had Black boyfriends and, Black colleagues. When I met Corinne, she just felt like family. Like, it was just an immediate thing. And I have long sort of said to her, I hope you don't feel like this tremendous pressure to be everything for me in terms of Blackness. And she said, you know, I mean, she always says this, but there was something missing, and I knew that, and I could stand in that space, and it didn't feel weighty at all. And so that's what family should be, I think. And I'm deeply, deeply grateful for it. And I encourage folks, especially transracial adoptees, to find chosen family.
So I have a comment here from Patrick, who's kind of, we're getting a couple that are like this, that are a bit of kind of pushback that would just be interesting to hear your response to. Patrick writes, has your guest thought about all the sacrifices her adopted parents made to raise her? Why paint them with such generalizations? I adopted kids from my drug-addicted cousin. My father struggled with addiction and mental health, and my mother used to say terrible things about him. It had nothing to do with being racist. It just had to do with people being in pain and feeling let down and disappointed. Maybe your guest is being a bit unfair to her adopted parents. What do you say to Patrick?
I say to Patrick that he should read the book. Because I don't paint my parents with broad strokes. And I don't feel that I am unfair towards them. Any memoirist will tell you, particularly if their family or who they're writing about are still alive, you know, you have to approach it with a kind of radical compassion. And that I hope is what I did. In terms of sacrifice, again, read the book, but my parents didn't believe in sacrifices. That wasn't their MO. They are artists, creatives, very, very much into us all being individuals. They were hands-off parents. They didn't believe in making sacrifices for us as such. That's not, you know, that wasn't the plan. So I don't often sort of think back on the sacrifices they made, because I don't think that they made that many. And I could say, you know, it's not my story to tell, but my sister would probably agree. But then in terms of, like, I don't know if Patrick is black or white, but this idea of doing us a favor or doing drug addicted children a favor, is really problematic. It's kind of this sort of savior mentality, wherein, I mean, should kids have drug addicted parents? No, but there's this kind of sense of, condescension about it. And rather than, a kind of a reality or a realness or an engagement with that experience, without sort of placing this immediate judgment that those parents who are drug addicted are bad people. It's not a moral, you can't place a moral judgment on folks who are struggling with their choices and with their addictions and with their living circumstances. And when kids are involved, yes, there should be stability, but there should not be a moral judgment.
Again, we're talking with Rebecca Carroll, cultural critic and author of Surviving the White Gaze, about transracial adoption and growing up black in a white family. And you can join the conversation if you have any questions or have an experience you'd like to share of transracial adoption as an adoptive parent or a person who was adopted. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. Get in touch on Twitter and Facebook at KQED Forum, or email your questions to forum@kqed.org. Let's go next to caller Rosemary in Livermore. Rosemary, you're on.
Hi, thank you. And thank you for this book, Ms. Carroll. It resonates. I was 14, I was a runaway. And my lover was a Yakima Indian from the state of Washington. So I was a ward of the court and my son was given up for adoption. So after 30 years or more, he called me on the phone. He looked for me for a long, long time. And so we tried really, really hard to connect and I found that what I had done was turned him out, so to speak. I abandoned him, but I was 14, to a Mormon family. And so as the years passed and we talked and met, I understood that he had never had any indigenous friends. He had no black friends. And so he was raised in a white middle-class Mormon home. He had a lot of the perks that I certainly couldn't have given him, but there was something missing. And I think Ms. Carroll is absolutely right. He would say things. These were throwaway lines like, I tried to volunteer once at a homeless shelter where there were a lot of Indian guys, and they hated me. And I thought, oh. And it was a throwaway line. And he did that a lot. And so he was in an all-white Mormon town, went to an all-white school. His Mormon parents, who certainly took good care of him, believed that they were a step closer to heaven, because that's part of the Mormon faith, to think that Native Americans are pretty much sent by God, and we're just a special race, a very special race. So after all of those years, I have to say, it did not turn out well. It really didn't. He also looked for his father, his Native American father, and found him, and was... I'm sorry, please go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was just because we don't have a ton of time left in the hour, but wanted to thank you for sharing that story. And it sounds like, again, just seeing some more of these patterns. I don't know, Rebecca Carroll, if you had any reflections.
Just that, and thank you for sharing that, but just the throwaway line, you know, which are the ones that are the most traumatic, because they're the most internalized. You know, as I said earlier, my fifth grade teacher told me I was very pretty for a black girl, which that was the outfacing sort of racism that I talked about a lot when I was growing up and trying to understand, my identity. But the part that really, really messed me up was the quote unquote throwaway line, which is most Black girls are ugly. I mean, she just tossed it out and I received it and internalized it in well into my 20s. So my heart just goes out to your son.
I have a comment. Stephen writes, on the one hand, acknowledging the experience and identity of race in a person of a different race gives us more empathy, compassion, and perhaps a deeper level of respect. But isn't talking about and focusing on race reinforcing the impersonal labels, attributes, and stereotypes? Doesn't it deprioritize individual personality and the, quote, content of their character? I know this is kind of going back to a bit of the conversation we had with kind of Dr. King and just, yeah, whether you have that conversation or not in the pitfalls, but also...
Listen, yeah. I mean, the content of my character is Black, right? So you can't separate the two things. I think that's absurd. And I also feel like the presumption there is my individuality is only valuable if I separate myself from my racial identity, which is... actually racist. I mean, thank you to the caller or for the question. But I absolutely reject the notion that the content of my character cannot exist without the value of my Blackness.
And let's try to go to one more caller. Kay in Berkeley, you're on.
Thank you to the caller for the question.
Kay, are you there? It sounds like we're hearing your radio in the background. All right, we'll try coming back to you in a moment. But another question I had for you, Rebecca Carroll, is there's a TV show I enjoy called This Is Us on NBC, which I'm sure you're familiar with, maybe come up in other interviews.
I've heard of it, yeah.
Which includes a character, Randall, played by Sterling K. Brown, brilliantly, who is Black and is adopted at birth by the Pearsons, a white family. And I think, you know, as someone who hasn't had the experience of transracial adoption, think the show has done a really good job, though, of exploring the layers of Randall's journey of self-discovery and the issue of race. And I know your book has been optioned to become a TV show. What do you hope increased visibility of these kinds of transracial adoption stories handled in a critical, intentional way, not just for kind of diversity's sake and casting, will do? Do you see an opportunity there?
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, I do love This Is Us, and I'm trying to get a copy of my book into the hands of Randall because I think he would appreciate it. The opportunity here, you know, we've got Colin Kaepernick's story coming out by way of Ava DuVernay, this, you know, my project, and I'm working on a couple of other projects as well. What I hope the opportunity will allow is for folks to realize and see that adoption stories are not just about adoption. They're bigger than adoption. There are so many interesting layers and complexities and insights and experiences. And certainly in this moment of quote unquote racial reckoning, you know, particularly Black adoptees who have existed in the parameters of whiteness for our lives have a lot to say and share about building on this reckoning.
I think we have Kay with us now in Berkeley to try and squeeze you in. Kay, you're on.
I'm a white adoptive parent of a biracial son. It sounds a lot like Rebecca. But he grew up and I lived in a mixed race, mixed class neighborhood in Berkeley, right next to the Oakland border, but it wasn't enough. I only realized later, and I talk about it in my book, Creole Son, that all of my extended family, all of my friends except for one, and all of the neighbors that I was friends with were white, and he then had a lot of you know, he could make Black friends and mixed race friends and Filipino friends and so forth, which was good, but it separated us. And I would do it very differently now. I mean, I'm older and he's 40. And so at any rate, I just wanted to say that it's not only growing up in a rural community or an all-white community that's the problem. It is that white people have to educate themselves and try to figure out how they can you know, be part of a of a Black community. Well, and that's hard.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing that comment, Kay. And Rebecca Carroll, we just have a couple minutes left, and I wanted to kind of get a closing question with you, because I saw you'd written that while you were in the process of writing this book, it was for a piece after Toni Morrison had passed, where you say, quote, "I may finally break free," in writing this book, "I may finally break free from the white gaze that I've worked so hard to survive." So I'm curious, now that you have completed the book, I'll ask, mm-hmm. did you find that freedom?
Yes. I found the intellectual freedom, the emotional fortitude, and what ultimately surviving the white gaze means to me is not just having survived, but having become the Black woman who I am today.
And I know that a lot of Black women writers were an influence in that way as well. And it sounds like would you potentially recommend kind of writing for folks who are kind of grappling, maybe in a similar position that you were, being able to write and process their story in that way?
Yes. I mean, we don't have
not publishing have time, that's like publishing a memoir, but you
right,
know,
right. I mean, I am 50, right? And so I waited a long ass time to write this book. I can't imagine having tried to write a memoir. I mean, I did try in my 20s, but I had to arrive at a place where I could stand in agency of my truth. And I was a devout journaler, and so I certainly encourage people to journal, but memoir writing is an enormous undertaking that requires a great deal of foundation, emotional foundation.
Well, thank you for taking the time to write and share your story with us. We've been talking with Rebecca Carroll, author of Surviving the White Gaze. I'm Ariana Prale. This is Forum. And we'll have more in the next hour with Mina Kim. Thanks for joining us.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.
Do you love your local bookstore? Well, I have the perfect event for you. This Saturday, April 27th, is Independent Bookstore Day. It's a day to celebrate your favorite local bookstore. I'm Olivia Allen Price, host of the Bay Curious podcast here at KQED, and I'm popping in to let you know that we will be hosting an event at Green Apple Books in San Francisco for the occasion. Come out for an author Q&A about the Bay Curious book. We'll be playing some Bay Area-themed trivia. There will be prizes and so much more. And the best part, tickets are donation-based, and all proceeds go to the Prisoners Literature Project. Learn more at kqed.org/live. I hope to see you there.
Take your Wi-Fi further with wall-to-wall Wi-Fi from Xfinity. With fast speeds and reliable coverage, home just got even sweeter with the Xfinity 10G network. Restrictions apply, not available in all areas. Actual speeds vary.